This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Discussing the California ballot initiatives. Matt, great talking to you.
Yeah, good to be on. It's been a couple months, and I'm glad to be talking about this. Obviously, for anyone who's actually voting in California, aside from the presidential election and whatever other state races, it's always interesting to see what these ballot proposals are, and I haven't actually looked into them as much as I think you have, so I'm considering this kind of an educational show for me to do, and I'll probably make some decisions about how I vote based on the conversation we have today.
Yeah, so these citizen initiatives, it's a form of direct democracy, and it's been a tradition in California for quite some time, I think at least a century.
Yeah, I don't know how it maps onto the way they do things in other states, but it's definitely a notable part of the ballot every year, or every, you know, couple of years here in California.
Yeah, it seems to coincide usually with the presidential cycle. And I guess before I get to the initiatives, I do want to comment on the pros and cons of direct democracy. So the argument in favor of direct democracy and citizens' referendums on populist grounds, that so with voting, when you vote for president, like, you really don't have that much of a, especially with Californians, like, your impact is minimal. And even with politicians, like, their voting record is going to be representative of special interest and donors. Besides, like, their personal biases, like, they're not going to match up with the voters. And it does seem like when voting for elected officials, yeah, even locally, like, you feel like you don't have that much of an impact. So I'd say with these citizens referendums, it is like the one case where you do actually have a impact on public policy. And then the kind of critique of direct democracy is especially with these initiatives, because a lot of voters are uninformed about initiatives, and they'll like watch an ad, and they also have people are busy in like a limited time frame, so they'll just hear what it's for, or they'll see an advertisement for it and vote a certain way, because there are a lot of these propositions are misleading, and yeah, they're sponsored by like special interest. And then there's also kind of I won't get into the philosophy about this on this show, but there are philosophical critiques of direct democracy that go back to Nietzsche and Plato.
Oh yeah, of course. Generally reasonably informed voter, I like to vote on these ballots. But you bring up a good point. I mean, these are things. Unlike, I think that to some degree, and this isn't always true, but to some degree, voting for your gut for president or you know, along party lines makes a degree of sense for a lot of people. But with these ballots, I think it's essential that you actually look into them a little bit, because, as you said, a lot of them are totally misleading. A lot of them have power. The great example of this is this Uber and Lyft one for this year, which we'll get into later. There's powerful interest groups behind it that are going to give it the best possible interpretation, and they have the furthest reach because they're big corporations. So with these, it does get dicey, just the fact that these kinds of things are going out for literally everyone in California to vote for. I don't think people everyone is going to be qualified to vote on these, to say the least.
There's this map on Twitter, and I'll link to it in the show post. just to get a kind of ideological feel for California. And there's these different ideologies: democratic socialism, social democracy, liberalism. I mean, democratic socialism, the far north coast, so that would be like Humboldt and Mendocino County. And then social democracy, I'm not sure how the guy who made this on Twitter, he's classifying that, but that shows up. I think he's classifying LA that way. And then liberalism, which I guess could be what some people might describe as neoliberalism, exists in these big, kind of big blocks around the Bay Area, San Diego, Riverside, a few parts of Central California. Then conservatism in the sparsely populated, like, inland areas, like mountains and the far north, like the northeastern segment, liberal conservatism in Orange County.
That one I kind of can just comment. I thought, I don't know what he means, the guy who made this graph, about by all of these definitions. I'd be interested to hear that. But I know what liberal conservatism means, or conservative liberalism, however you want to put it. I.e., like, you know, sort of neoconservatism, liberalism with guns behind it, with, you know. It's very on point to call Orange County that. And that was what jumped out at me was, I can't attest for every definition here, but definitely Orange County as liberal conservatism. Pennsylvania as well, Chester County, which I'm familiar with, is liberal conservatism. It's spot on. You know, it's wealthy, middle class, traditionally conservative, but now kind of blue state types.
Yeah, so then populism, and there's right-wing populism. I mean, that's a category, but just populism in general. You see a small little patch. And I think that would be a Trinity County. And the counties that are populist usually are kind of the Obama to Trump voters. And those are mostly, like, not so much in California, but, like, in the upper Midwest.
Yeah,
and
the Rust.
But the thing is, like, that area, like, the far northern region of California, like, state of Jefferson, they do have a long tradition of backing anti-establishment candidates on both the left and the right. And I want to cover the ballot initiatives first, but I do want to discuss... we'll touch upon some of the congressional races in California, but I want to start off with the first initiative. So this is Prop 14, and on stem cell research, and stem cell is not... I mean, a stem cell is not a guy who is a STEM major who's, like, struggling to get laid. It means something completely different.
I mean, it could be that, too, but go on.
Yeah, so there was a previous bond measure on stem cells, and embryonic stem cells, it used to be like a really big culture war, and it was social conservatives were opposed to this.
Catholic Church was, I think.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where the Overton window moves, and like they decide it's sort of a losing battle, and it's not worth it, so it's sort of, it's no longer really a controversial issue, so this is primarily about the funding. The other thing is it used to be banned on a federal level, so at the time when the first bond measure was passed, like California was taking it up to be like groundbreaking on stem cell research. But the thing is like these are like these massive bonds which the state would be responsible for the debt. Like the benefits would be private companies. And the thing is the benefits for this would go to the whole nation when it comes to research. But California would be responsible for the massive costs. And there's so many other parts of the nation, like obviously like the Research Triangle in North Carolina, that are involved. And then the other thing is like there's been like a lack of results of any major breakthroughs from the last bonds. And so on this one, I'm going to have to say a reluctant no.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Not to get lost in the weeds of this, but... this, and I don't even know how much you know about this, but the reason why people were opposed to it from a culture wars perspective, why was it that they used fetal stem cells, so from aborted babies? Is that it?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
That was a controversy,
okay.
But it's less.
To clarify that. But I agree with what you're saying, basically, about the way this is funded and everything. Yeah, no, I would agree. I don't intend to vote for that one. I think what you're saying makes sense.
So the next one is Prop 15, and this is about commercial property taxes. So how they're frozen when property taxes are assessed. So the property taxes are based on when they're initially assessed. So in some cases, a business might be paying property taxes based on rates from like 40 years ago, and it does create this concept of a split rule where you can have similar businesses like right next to each other where one one company is paying like dramatically more. It is like explicit favoritism. Yeah, I mean, it does give like one business a strong upper hand. It's bad for like newer businesses are obviously at a huge disadvantage. So just like the, I think like the favoritism, that, I mean, that's a strong enough issue to vote for this.
Yeah, you're saying it's good for existing kind of legacy corporations, not good for new businesses, but overall good for urbanism.
Legacy corporations, like the different like kind of oil refineries. I mean, one issue is that Mark Zuckerberg's charity is actually backing this, and with big tech, it depends. Like some of them, I mean, it is a newer industry compared to more established industries, so it is possible like big tech would be less impacted, but it depends like on which company. And but I have to say, like, the main reason I'm voting for this is I just think it would be good for urbanism, because under the current tax system, like, there's less of an incentive to improve one's property. So yeah, you could see like massive parking lots, strip malls, and underutilized property being retrofitted. And like one thing I've noticed this, and I'm sure you've noticed this too, driving around LA, is you're in these like commercial corridors that are in areas that are very like desirable as far as real estate costs, but then you do see buildings would kind of run down. You see lots of parking lots, just lots of underutilized property, and it just, I think it is bad. It's bad for walkability and just for like urban cohesion. So yeah.
Yeah, it's sense of one of these things that plays in the pockets of big corporations that I don't trust, but at the same time, I'll take it over nothing.
A lot of these are flawed. Most of them, like, you just have to kind of weigh the pros and the cons. But one example I'll give from urbanism is it will be interesting to see what impact this has, because the Los Angeles Country Club is the big golf course. It's north of Century City and west of Beverly Hills. Yeah. If you look at that in Google Maps, it's massive. Like, yeah, I mean, they're paying property taxes from way, way back. I'm not sure the official year, but when it was founded, about I guess a century ago. And you could literally like double Century City, but then have a space left over for like this massive new urban park. It could really have a transformational impact on urbanism, and then just also kind of like the reduction in sprawl.
Yeah. No, I, for me, as you have said, I think it's a yes with some reservations.
I mean, I'll add, like, there are, like, loopholes for small businesses, but there are, even despite the loopholes, there are some concerns about the commercial landlords passing down the cost to small businesses and to the consumers. So there are some concerns about that. And then just the issue of, like, how the money will be spent. So most of it seems to be going to education, but just how these like unaccountable like bureaucrats, like, I'm not like a fiscal conservative, but I still think ideally like where the money is going to, like how it's being spent, like how the current bureaucracy hasn't, they're not always the most effective. So I support subsidizing government projects if they're proven to be effective and on raising funds. And then the other, another reason I support this is you do have this kind of like rentier class that makes their fortune off of real estate, but they're not producing enough, necessarily creating anything of economic value. So I think it would kind of reform that element to a degree. But I would just say, so I'm voting yes, and primarily the main reason being that it's good for urbanism.
Yep. Yeah. No, likewise.
And then Prop 16 is that's the affirmative action initiative that would have impacts on education, universities, UC system, and then also grants for creating small businesses. So I'm obviously, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely opposed to this. I mean, no real like personal benefits, and it's part of this whole like kind of push of this racial agenda. And I would just say that the concept, it's intellectually, it's an intellectually bankrupt idea, and it doesn't take into account, just puts people into boxes. Yeah, puts people into boxes based on some kind of hierarchy, but without, without even taking into account the person's economic background. So, but I would also say, even from a left-wing perspective, affirmative action is basically a form of austerity.
Yeah, I mean, because why? Because you potentially have to give less to people with less money because it focuses on a different factor than sheer economic factors?
I mean, that's pretty close to it. Like, from a more traditional Marxist standpoint, it's based on the idea of scarcity and a zero-sum game competition over economic resources. It's part of this kind of overall push. You see it with, like, woke capital and a lot of the whole education, the whole education system is pushing, like, a more agenda on race, so...
Not on this show a million times.
Yeah, no. It's also kind of extremely divisive.
Oh, no, it certainly is. I mean, we could talk about this, for a long time, how it's divisive, how it's not actually as progressive as it seems to be. With Prop 16, what concretely would this do? Do you have a sense of that? Because on some level, it's like, oh, this is like the BLM, you know, easy for woke people to just hit yes, have it open, yeah. The booklet that California sends out, it says Prop 16 allows diversity as a factor in public employment, education, and contracting decisions. Legislative constitutional amendment permits government decision making policies to consider race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in order to address diversity by repealing constitutional provision prohibiting such policies. Fiscal impact: no direct fiscal effect on state and local entities. The effects of the measure depend on the future choices of state and local government entities and are highly uncertain. So it's not proposing anything. It's basically, I mean, I basically think it's sort of insane. I mean, it's basically saying that you can discriminate based on race, sex, all those other things I listed in employment decisions.
It's saying discrimination's okay if it's one particular group against another, because either we can have, like, the state having a strong role to protect all citizens against discrimination, or we can just say there's, like, freedom of association and all groups just look out for their own group. Maybe they hire their own, like, that kind of more form of, like, ethnic, like, nepotism versus the idea of a meritocracy. We can either go in one direction or the other, but this idea that one group, that it's okay, that the state says that it's okay for one group to discriminate it's an abhorrent concept. And as I said, like, the logic behind it is intellectually fraudulent, so I'm just going to have to say a very, very, very strong no.
I mean,
on this one.
I remember when they brought this up, I think it was over the summer, right? And it was partial, or maybe it's nothing to do with all the crazy things. But either way, I mean, this, yeah, it's an easy no. I'm surprised we don't even have to go into it that much more, I don't think. I think it's for what it is, it's an easy no. It's kind of, you know, wokeness on the ballot, and it's an easy no.
And then there's the issue of expanding voter rights. So the two initiatives are Prop 17, restoring voting rights for felons, and then Prop 18 is allowing 17-year-olds who are going to be 18 at the time of the election to vote in the primary. So they're both about expanding mass democracy, and it kind of brings into the whole, like, this whole idea of voting rights, expanding, like, mass democracy, as many people should vote as possible. First, I'll ask you, Matt, which one do you think has a stronger case behind it?
I would say this might be the first things that we differ on. I'm trying to see what you're saying. Prop 17, for clarity, Prop 17 is the felon one, and Prop 18 is the age-based one?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so I think I would say, with felons, it's always going to be case by case, but I'm very much against doing it as a blanket policy. That you know, I recognize that there are felons who probably, you know, are rehabilitated and should be able to vote, but basically I'm against that across the board. Not without, you know, extenuating circumstances, which they're probably never, you know, that doesn't even really make sense. So basically I'm against that. In terms of the younger people voting thing, I'm not terribly in favor of that either. I think that I think that there's a lot of 17-year-olds who are way more qualified to vote than a lot of adults, but I think that I'm basically, in the abstract, I'm in favor of, you know, not, I'm in favor of restricting who can, that sounds terrible, but I'm basically in favor of restricting who can vote more. So therefore, I'm probably, would probably say no on both of these. Because I think obviously there's a lot of 17-year-olds who are qualified to vote, who are good citizens, informed, should vote, and there's a lot of felons for whom the same can be said. To answer your question, maybe I'm a little bit more sympathetic to the age-based one, but basically I would have to say, I'm knee-jerk no to both.
I mean, I have mixed feelings about it because obviously there's a wide variety of individuals and. Certain crimes should obviously be excluded, but then there's the idea that the punishment is the sentence itself. It's not their lifetime condemnation. Like, if there's issues of criminal justice reform, if there's a large block where felons, like, they don't have any say. So with Prop 17 on felons voting, I would say I'll vote yes, but reluctantly with some reservations. And then with Prop 18 on students, it's the same issue, like, as everyone's an individual. The reason I'm going to vote no on that, I think with felons, like, regardless of what you think about, like, their moral character or moral failing, like, I think they have a unique take on from their experience that the rest of society doesn't. Mm-hmm. But I would say that with students, like, I could see, so we were talking 17-year-olds, we're talking high school seniors, where maybe the educational system is maybe encouraging them to take a certain stance, and I would actually be more, like, I would be open to allowing teenagers to vote, like, lowering the voter age to 16. For local elections, local referendums, if, like, the education system was much more decentralized. And this is almost basic bitch kind of conservative talking points about, like, liberal indoctrination. But it is true that, like, education system might,
the media might
push them to vote a certain way. So it is, so yeah, Mike, my conclusion is a reluctant yes on 17 and a reluctant no on 18.
Yeah, mine's no for both. I see where you're coming from with 17. I do want to say with 18, because I kind of went off a little bit. 18 is very specific. It's not that it's just letting 17-year-olds vote. It's that it's letting 17-year-olds vote in primaries if they're going to turn 18. So in some ways, it's just like a fluke thing. Like, it's like, I don't know. That one, I just want to clarify in the favor of not sowing any kind of disinformation that the one about felons is specific. It's restoring voting rights or not. This one with the 17 and 18-year-old thing, it's a very specific thing about whether or not they can vote in primaries if they're going to be 18 by the time of the general. So it's not, they're not as comparable as I probably made them sound when I first talked about them, but still the general point stands. And to your point about no on 18, I mean, I remember being 17. Well, I actually missed voting in the 2012 election by a month, and I'm not necessarily saying I'm glad I missed it, but I can definitely say that my perspective on politics at that time was not especially valuable. I mean, I did not have a good take on things. I was just kind of what was cool. So, I mean, that's...
I voted Libertarian the first election I could vote in 2004.
Yeah, you know, things like... Well, you at least were thinking outside the box. I mean, but I can also, not to get lost in the weeds on these ones, but I could say that teenagers don't make informed decisions, but do I really think most adults do? Of course not. So I can see it from either way, but yeah.
So the next one is Prop 19. To give kind of some introduction to this, is Prop 13 was the ballot initiative back in the 70s that froze property taxes when it was first assessed when the person purchased it. The commercial property tax is reforming Prop 13, but for commercial property taxes, not residential, even though there is some misinfo about that. But the thing is, with Prop 19, it's anyone who is over 55, and then also they're adding in people who are victims of fires and the disabled. And I mean, I was under the impression that if you're disabled, you're not even allowed to own assets if you're receiving benefits for that. But let's just focus on the, yeah, I mean, on the people who are over 55, because they're sort of the main benefactors. So this is primarily being pushed. The main backing behind this is the real estate industry, but it is relevant to that UNSRA article I wrote about the intergenerational wealth gap.
Yeah, how is it relevant to that? Going more into that.
So homeowners who have owned their property much longer, like say someone who purchased a home.
So it's good for. I'm sorry, I'm kind of dense when it comes to financial.
Say someone who purchased a home back in the 80s and. They're
good
paying these low rates. Yeah, long term.
Yeah.
They're already benefiting from Prop 13. Well, let's say a younger family who just purchased recently, someone who's just starting a family, the burden is put on those people. So it is explicitly favoring one generation over the other. And what this does is that if they move, then they're able to continue the low property tax rates, they can transfer it over to a new property as opposed to the way things are now. They lose that if they move. It would incentivize moving, and that's why the real estate industry is behind this, because if more people are moving, there's more profit for real estate agents and so forth. And then the other issue is when those people, they do pass down their inheritance to their children, then there are higher taxes on the inheritors. The inheritors would lose those benefits. So it's a way of passing down the burden to the younger generation. So that, I mean, that alone is pretty,
is a pretty strong
reason for it to be a hard no. Yeah, I mean, is there some potential incentive to downsize, which might open up more real estate, make it available for younger people? That could possibly be an outcome. Or you could just see like a lot of wealthy people from the Silicon Valley or the west side of LA just crowding out places like Lake Tahoe or Santa Barbara and pushing out more younger families. So
no.
Yeah, I mean that could very likely happen. So yeah, I would just say a strong no in this.
Yeah, no, strong no.
I would say that if this passes and the affirmative action passes, those combined, that would be a pretty strong middle finger to all white millennials living in California.
Yeah, sounds like it. And I mean, I have a bad feeling that that's going to be exactly what happens, because that's the state we live in.
The major newspapers that are left-leaning, they're supporting affirmative action and opposing this. And the California GOP is actually taking a neutral stance on this. They're refusing to endorse this one way or the other. But I do think on an individual basis, there's a pretty large segment of people who are probably going to vote for both.
Yeah, kind of like, not to get personal, but that last time we hung out and we were driving through the hills, you remember that house? That kind of mansion in the hills with the Biden-Harris sign and the BLM sign? That crowd.
Wealthy boomer homeowners who have like Biden-Harris and BLM on their property. It's like a pretty big constituency in California, kind of the same... similar constituency behind NIMBYism as well. Yeah, I'll move on to Prop 20. And this restricts parole to some certain criminal offenses. So I'm generally opposed to these kind of crime measures that are just kind of one size fits all. Mm-hmm. And they don't take into account like each case. And that can be a difficult situation too. But I'm just going to have to say no on this.
Because when I first read this, I'm thinking it restricts the amount of parole that can be, you know, it restricts the severity of the punishment or something. But you're saying it restricts, it adds to the potential. Okay, yeah. I would say no as well then. But yeah, these are tricky to read sometimes.
I mean, this is the whole issue of criminal justice, like finding out, like some cases, like finding out who is the most dangerous or at risk to offend. And people throw out these kind of slogans, tough on crime and or soft on crime, and there's a big push to reform criminal justice now. Just on those grounds, on one size fits all, I'm going to have to say no. And so the next one is Prop 21, and this is about a rent control. I have some mixed feelings about this because, I mean, there are problems with a lot of renters now with the pandemic, and it's especially tough economic situation. This would it wouldn't be statewide rent control, but it would give individual cities more authority to expand rent control. But I'll kind of explain like my reasons for opposing this. Is the thing about like the way rent control works is I think it's just not really an effective way to provide housing for large numbers of people.
Yeah, because it ends up restricting who it can kind of put a dent in.
Very arbitrary.
Yeah. Some real estate people, you know, older people I know who own property, and they're, well, I guess obviously they're against this, but I've heard their reasoning, and I mean, it makes it harder to just facilitate. I'm not too educated on this one, but it makes it harder just to facilitate the basic interaction of the basic exchange of renting apartments.
So yeah, it does like a small number of people arbitrarily benefit. Rent control, I'd say it's bad for YIMBYism, like increasing the overall supply. It does remove incentives for property to being improved. And landlord who has people in there who are on rent control, like they're less likely to improve and redevelop their property. And then, and obviously I'm not saying that's good if their people are being displaced, but just overall bad for YIMBYism. And if you can look up like the main backers of this, like one of them, like Michael Weinstein, the president of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, and what's notable about his group, he's probably like one of the key figures for NIMBYism in LA, but the thing is it's sort of like there's a kind of progressive wing of like NIMBYism who are generally kind of behind this, but so I would say reluctantly no.
Yeah, I would say so too. It's well-intentioned with bad effects. There was something like this on the ballot in 2018 as well. Is this basically the same bill? Do you remember what I'm talking about?
You know what? I think I do remember that. And I mean, we do need to build a more affordable housing. Housing is huge, but the problem that I have about rent control is you have cities like Santa Monica and Berkeley that are very like they're not willing to do anything about housing, but it is a way for them to virtue signal.
Exactly. I mean, this is classic, and this normally applies more to social issues, and I'm more progressive on economic type issues like this. But I think this is an example of an economic type issue that is kind of better on paper liberalism.
And then Prop 21 is it would exempt the gig economy from labor protections of full-time employees. It's the most expensive ballot initiative in California history, backed by Uber and Lyft, and like all the ads, every YouTube video now, like the ads are for this, and they're very like emotionally driven but vague, and they have no information about what it will do. I mean, that massive advertisement campaign by corporate interests is enough to oppose this, but I do think like right now, like the post-pandemic economy, like the gig economy, and like lack of any kind of like high-paying jobs, like this really does set a really dangerous precedent for full-time jobs that pay well being replaced by these kind of low-wage gig economy jobs. So I would say a very strong no on this.
Yeah, very strong no. What exactly would it limit? It would limit the benefits they have to give or something? Exempt app-based transportation and delivery companies from... it's not even just Uber and Lyft. It's Uber Eats. I know so many people who...
I mean, another thing I'll say about these apps, like Uber Eats, is it's also contributing to like the economic like destruction of small businesses like in the post-pandemic economy. Yeah. So I'm very strongly opposed to this.
Maybe it's another one. I don't like it, and I want to make it as hard for these companies as possible. But I mean, it's kind of interesting because you're right. You get these ads, and they're very emotional based, but they can't make the text of this sound good at all. And actually, I'm optimistic it won't pass because this text sounds so bad. I mean, listen, exempts app-based transportation delivery companies from providing employee benefits to certain drivers. Like, how do you make that sound good? They're trying, but hopefully it won't pass because, screw them.
So no on that. And Prop 23, it would force dialysis clinics to have a physician on site. And I'm opposed to this because I think it would drive up costs and limit accessibility.
remember that. Sorry for interrupting. I remember these dialysis ads. I guess some of these are just back on the ballot. Permanent issues, right? As Dio Khan's talking about the permanent issues, one of them in California is dialysis.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one thing is these kind of regulations drive up the cost of healthcare. So if you allow like nurse practitioners to provide a lot of procedures that physicians do, like that could sort of ease the cost of healthcare. And also, like, they're saying that it's needed for oversight, but I think just there's other ways to have stronger regulations, and then also the concern about lawsuits, if there was, like, malpractice, the threat of a lawsuit, so I really don't see how this is necessary. It would just drive up cost of healthcare, so yeah, I'll say no on this.
Yeah, it also makes it easier, given that at this point I'm no on everything except 15, but keep going.
And then Prop 24 is consumer and online privacy, and on the surface this actually does sound good. And initially I was leaning towards voting for this. It claims that it would make parts of California's privacy law stronger. But the thing is then there's a lot of things that are kind of suspicious about it, because there's this one, like, very wealthy individual who's primarily backing it, and it does not have the support. It doesn't have, like, the backing from a lot of the key, like, internet privacy and tech advocacy groups or civil liberty groups. The ACLU opposes this, and I'm not necessarily a huge fan of the ACLU, but even the most reputable, like, privacy groups, they're not coming out for this. Another thing that's suspicious is that a lot of the major tech companies haven't even taken a strong stand either for or against. So that, I mean, that's a bit, that's a bit odd. Like,
yeah,
how these kind of bill legislations, like how they're crafted, because a lot of reports that it could actually weaken privacy protections, and then also the law makes it harder update the law to keep up with tech, and requiring a new proposition for each new change. So that, I mean, that's problematic. So I initially was sympathetic.
Clothing.
Yeah.
Why did the ACLU oppose it? Because they say it doesn't go far enough and creates a precedent that could limit it from going where it needs to go in the future. This kind of thing.
That could be. It could be a wolf's in sheep's clothing. But it just seems like I'm reading contradictory information. Some that's selling it as having benefits for privacy and protecting online personal data, and then some thing of it potentially being having harmful elements. So I'm just going to say that if there's that much confusion, I think that's enough to just to vote no. So I'm going to have to say no.
I agree. Yep, same.
And then Prop 25, that would replace cash bail with a risk assessment system. So pretrial release from pretrial detention would be based upon public safety rather than ability to pay, and lower risk would be released upon their trial. High risk would remain in jail. I'm going to vote yes.
I think so too.
And what this thing is interesting is that there has been opposition from both sides. So I'll give an example, like what Mayor de Blasio in New York has done with cash bail. His handling has been disastrous, but I don't think this seems much more nuanced and looking at taking into account each case, so I don't think it's comparable, because there's going to be opposition from Law and Order conservatives. And then there are actually people on the left or the woke side saying that the risk assessment could be used to justify racism. So, I mean, I don't know about that, so...
No, I've always felt the way about cash bail as a lot of people feel about the Electoral College. Like, it's never totally made sense to me that if you can pay more. I mean, I'm old enough that I kind of get it now, but yeah, I've always thought there should be a case-by-case more of a risk assessment. So I'll probably vote yes, even though I'm sure there's fine arguments.
But just kind of interesting to see, like, would you say that overall our consensus is probably actually ironically closer to the left, just looking at the initiatives overall?
I lean towards a certain kind of pro-middle class progressivism, I guess. It's California, so this stuff is kind of like, what version of progressivism do you want? And I am more in favor of a populist progressive. These are coming down from powerful interest groups.
There is, like, with the affirmative action measure, Prop 16, like, there is this massive, like, woke push.
And like, Uber, you know, which said, you know, if you're racist, if you tolerate racism, delete Uber, whatever. They're woke capital. And they're trying to even put a, not even really, but they're trying to put some kind of woke spin on whatever one, what is it, 16, the one about 22, sorry. They're trying to even put, you know, not a woke spin, but they're signaling in that direction. They're having people of color.
Yeah, their ads are. They're not explicitly woke, but they're trying to send a message that they are for, like, the working class of color in their ads. So, like, it doesn't match, like how we would vote yes or no does not match up, like, any party platform or special interest. But a lot of cases, people will just get, like, those flyers from the Democratic Party, Republican Party. There's also one from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, too. The major newspapers, LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle, or San Diego, San Jose, and then just kind of vote based on the paper they read. That's another reservation I have about this kind of direct democracy, is people will just vote along those lines. But it will kind of be interesting as far as, like, the matchup. So I think I said, like, if certain things pass at the same time, what message it will have. Like, say, like, what if affirmative action passes and then gig economy passes? Like, that would be a strong signatory for woke capital. Or if the property tax reform and affirmative action, the message that sends to, like, kind of white millennials, when you put different ballot initiatives together, like, the kind of political caucuses it forms.
Yeah, no, it's definitely interesting. And in terms of direct democracy, I'm listening to an audiobook of Christopher Lash's The Revolt of the Elites, and in the opening chapter he talks about how, you know, democracy isn't a conglomeration of individuals, it's a conglomeration of different kind of self-governing groups, and, neither here nor there on direct democracy, but people are going to ultimately vote in line with some kind of group, even if it's kind of out there, like, even if it's people listening to this podcast and voting perfectly in line with what you said, which is kind of what I'm going to do with one exception. I'm going off on maybe a tangent here, but everyone ends up having their way to make their decisions on this, and it's rarely made in a vacuum. Everyone, you know, comes to a consensus with some group of people and votes accordingly.
Yeah, we'll go over, like, the congressional races. It is, like, the top two runoff, so you get the third parties or the more kind of eccentric candidates from the primary round, and then the second round, it's more generic. It's just, like, top two, usually excludes third parties. And as for the Republicans running, they seem to either be true cons. Like, a true con is just someone, like, fiscally conservative, like, pro-business, small taxes, hate socialism, and then a few maybe they're pro-life. And then the more kind of establishment GOP candidates. But the thing is, like, so in California, like, there are these more kind of nationalist, populist candidates. Like, I think an example of, I'm not sure if you follow her on Twitter, like, Vitska is this woman running for Senate as a Republican in Delaware, like, on a more nationalist, populist campaign, and, like, a big focus be on, regulating big tech, and tend to be big on issues like opposing globalization and mass immigration. There's probably about several nationwide. I don't think there's a single one in California. So in my district where I am, I have, like, the state Senate race, and then Congress, more kind of a true conservative candidates versus an establishment Democrat.
Yeah, I haven't even looked into these that much. I might vote Republican just for the hell of it.
Actually, Democrats, there are candidates who are more interesting. There's a Yang supporter, David Kim, who's running as a Yang Democrat against the Democratic incumbent. So we're seeing this now. It's two Democrats running for Congress as opposed to having it based, it's the top two rather than based by party. So David Kim's a Yang Democrat, and this is the district around downtown LA and Koreatown. And then in your district in the Valley, there's Erica Rhodes. She's actually not going to run until 2022. Besides David Kim, I think the other interesting candidate is Shahid Buttar. He's like a Bernie Sanders supporter who is running against Nancy Pelosi. And he's pretty far left, but I would definitely, like, if I was in San Francisco, I'd support him over yep. Pelosi for sure. So it seems yep. does seem on the Democratic side, like, there are some more kind of interesting candidates. I used to be more interested in getting involved with, like, campaigns, but I mean, I haven't been as less enthusiastic about, like, electoral politics lately.
Yeah, well, no, it's not a good year for them at all at the national level or local or state levels. It's just not. It's rather depressing in a lot of ways.
And then for president, for starters, with you, Matt, you're going to vote for Trump.
I am. I could go into that. I'm going to do it just because this is literally my only reason. I shouldn't even say that. I'm voting for Trump because I know that I want to wake up on, and I probably won't because it'll probably be delayed, but I know that I will be happier if I wake up on November 4th and he got reelected. I'll be happier about what that means for the country, for the mood that was taken, that people are still angry at, you know, the elites, for lack of a better term, and they still don't trust people like Joe Biden, because I don't, and I don't trust the trajectory of the Democratic Party and of the way that a certain group of people, a certain group of liberal, again, it's tired concepts here, but a certain group of liberal elites feel wrong and think, you know, it's the Trevor Noah of it all. I am still as opposed to that as ever, and I want to signal that. Now, that's not exactly a super intellectual, you know, Andrew Yang, this is going to make people's lives better in this way type of reason, but...
Yeah, I do understand that case for Trump, because Trump, his economic policies with the pandemic and failing with the stimulus, and first I've got to say, like, it is true, like, there is a degree of truth that there is obstructionism from, like, Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic establishment, but there's still a lot Trump could do. He could give a stimulus using the Treasury, and then also, like, he hasn't... he needs to put pressure on the Republicans, and he is kind of caving in to these, like pro-business, like economic conservatives, like, he is caving in to them. So, yeah, he has, as far as, like, offering material benefit to, not just his supporters, to all American citizens, but I do kind of understand the argument of just voting Trump purely on kind of a tribal basis, because I mean, that is, like, the reality. Like, we are fragmented, and then just what Biden represents, like, I'm sure you listened to the show I did with Caleb Maupin, who's a leftist, about, like, a lot of dangerous, not so much just, like, dangerous, but just that he just epitomizes, like, the entire power structure, the deep state, world capital, a lot of the big, like, the Northeastern financial establishment, they're all behind Biden. And then it's also a pathway for Kamala Harris to become president. I mean, I think that would set us in a really kind of dangerous precedent. And also concerns about a greater push to, like, restrict freedom of speech. As far as saying, like, who is the least bad, I'm not going to vote for Trump, but I might consider tepidly backing him if I were in a swing state. I think just what Biden symbolizes, like, just the return to normalcy, like, going back to the 2010s, like, I find that extremely insulting.
I find it extremely insulting, too. And think about how that kind of tees things up for 2024, for going forward. Any sense that this was a fluke, that things are going to go back to normal, and, you know, the educated, you know, good guy liberals are going to take back over. And any sense that, and I, first of all, I don't, regardless of if that's the narrative or not, I don't think it's true, so I do think this stuff will still come to a head. I still think we're in for a lot of, you know, another chaotic few years, if not another, you know, chaotic decade. But even just that narrative, yes, I find it insulting. And I would rather, I tweeted something about this, I would rather tee up 2024 as a year where there can really be new faces on either side. I mean, if you, like, I'm not exactly, a Yang true believer at this point, but if one were, like, I mean, he would be a great candidate in 2024 if Biden loses again, and they say, oh, all these, you know, if he loses again, and if he loses again because of the Rust.
What if it's like 2024 is Nikki Haley versus Kamala Harris? I mean, that would be sad.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, you know, I have other things in my life, but, like, I'd just be totally blackpilled on politics for the foreseeable future. And I feel like if Trump wins again, there's still some kind of hope. Like, I mean, even though he has been kind of an establishmentarian in a lot of ways, he's still a big middle finger to the establishment. And it's obvious that he is. I mean, for as disappointed as he's been in certain ways, it's obvious that these people still absolutely abhor him.
I would agree that, like, I understand voting for him purely on symbolism, because, like, even though, like, I'm disappointed with Trump, and I dislike a lot of his policies, but it is true, the main thing to praise Trump for, like, the selling point for Trump, is basically that he is despised by all the worst people in the world.
Yeah, totally. I agree. I don't know, personally, I don't think Trump's as bad. I won't even get into that. Who cares, right? I'm fond of the guy in certain respects. But yeah, I know he's still hated by all the worst people in the world. He's hated by a group of people who have a lot in society. They have all the influence in society, and they just can't stand that they don't have the highest office in their pocket. And for that alone, he's worth supporting. And yeah, just that I think it still represents something healthy and good if he wins. Just to I guess, and I haven't even followed, like, well, I won't even mention that, but The argument is that, you know, maybe things will, I think Moldbug or someone, and this is a crew of saying people saying this, you know, that things will, it will kind of placate people, and we can start having better conversations once Biden wins. That is
one case for Biden you can make for Biden being president, because I think you could more likely see like a fusion between dissident right and dissident left, as opposed to how polarized things are now, because he epitomizes kind of neoliberal corporate centrism, so you would see populist right and populist left, and you already are seeing some of that fusionism now, but I think that would be a trend of more so if Biden were elected.
Yeah, probably, but who knows how effective that would be. I mean, look, I can see that way, but
to be honest, I don't really see like a populist centrism taking off nationally.
Because
of how polarized things are now.
That.
I mean, we're both in California, so the presidential vote doesn't matter. Is not that significant with the Electoral College. So I'm gonna voter write in the candidates for the American Solidarity Party. It's Brian Carroll and Amar Patel. Primarily, they're a party like for the ideas of like distributism. Obviously, third parties, like, they rarely get elected, but they do spread ideas. I think what's really important is like to build up local communities and to empower people to build up independent institutions and economic freedom, like sources of independence, income sources, economic independence, and sources of income that are not dependent upon corporations or a strong centralized government. So I'm voting them just to kind of spread out economic ideas of distributism and independence. I also like they're discussing the importance of social capital. I think Yang touched upon that initially as well. So touching upon important issues that are being neglected by the two major parties. And I have backed third-party presidential candidates in the past. Actually, in fact, Trump in 2016, that was actually the first time in my life where I actually did vote for a major party candidate.
Yeah, it's interesting with you, Robert. I mean, we're kind of opposites. Like, well, not opposites, but a lot of people kind of come to third-party candidates after years of disillusionment. You started in a place of disillusionment, I think, in the Bush.
First election, 2004, I voted Libertarian. 2008, I voted for Chuck Baldwin of the Constitution Party, and I was also a Ron Paul supporter at the time. And then also 2012, and another third party, and then, yeah, 2016, it was, that was the first time a major party candidate.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. I guess we could touch briefly on, if you don't mind, I mean, do you think, well, what about Kanye? You want to talk about him?
Initially, I was open-minded at first. At this point, I just think he's not serious. He's just doing it for publicity. Like, I was willing to give him a chance, but maybe his detractors are right. It just doesn't.
The California ballot, and this is a little bit interesting, is the only reason I bring it up. He's actually a VP candidate.
Oh, yeah, I saw that with American Independent Party, which is a very kind of right-wing third party.
Yeah, right-leaning. It was hard to tell. It's just an interesting move. I guess Rocky De La Fuente has run.
Oh, yeah. He just got Kanye on
the VP ticket for the mutual benefit thing.
And then Kanye was saying on Twitter to write his name in instead of voting for that other ticket. So two Kanyes running against each other. And one thing I say about Trump is past elections, there's always been like some kind of third party, but this election, there's really not. I think
there isn't.
Trump has actually made things more polarized, which is like where these two political tribes, like you have to vote red or blue, and you can't vote third party. Because I remember like in last election, it was like 2016, there was like Gary Johnson.
Yeah, technically
and Jill
Gary
Stein.
Johnson. Good year, yeah. Gary Johnson actually won some counties in 2016, I think, but obviously.
Yeah, Ross Perot was like the last like serious third party candidate. He actually did win masses of counties. I think Trinity County, we were talking in the beginning, was like populism. I think Perot may have won that, and then we had like Nader and Buchanan. So yeah, unfortunately I don't really see third parties like taking off in the near future. No. Matt, is there anything you'd like to add about any other like thoughts on the election?
Because hopelessly a political animal, and I care about this more than I should. I mean, looking out at the country now, who do you think is going to win the presidency?
If I had to guess, I would say Biden, but I also think, like, polls are not always reliable, and then also, like, but the thing is, even, like, with the whole scandal about, like, Hunter Biden, like, it just seems like the only people talking about it are, like, partisan Republicans and Trump supporters, so I don't even know. I've only kind of followed it like vaguely, so yeah, like polls are not always like reliable, but the lead is much more than it was for Hillary. So if I had to guess, I'd say Biden. I mean, I could very well be wrong, and I also think like Trump. I think where Trump really screwed up is the stimulus is obviously, but also his whole campaign, also like the Pence and the Kamala Harris debate is like. There's no strong populist argument that was used in the campaign. Like basically everything is that Biden is going to be used as a Trojan horse for America to become a communist country. Yeah, I mean, that's just, that's not effective at all. Like, no strong populist case. So those two things, even though, like, I think even, like, with handling of the pandemic, I think those two things, like, a populist argument in the debates and then a strong stimulus. I think those two things, his campaign could have been salvageable. But at this point, he's failed to do that.
Yep. Yeah. No. I basically agree with what you're saying. I mean, you gotta. Unfortunately, I don't even like to say this because I'm trying to be optimistic and I want Trump to win. But, yeah. I don't know. I think Biden, the energy's a little bit on his side just because Trump is not giving the right message. So that's unfortunately. Seems likely, but there's a part of my gut that still can just see all this culture war stuff, and this isn't the best reason for him to win, but still, all this kind of culture war stuff boiling over and just hit him being a lightning rod. And I think that's a little bit of what happened in 2016. I think it was two things with 2016. I think it was both that he had a very strong populist promise, but also that he was a lightning rod for these culture war things, and I think he is still that lightning rod, and that could still lead him to victory. But who knows? I mean, I'm excited, nervous, whatever to watch because it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, well, it will be interesting to watch, and what will happen? Like a lot of the predictions of, not just like predictions of like worst case scenarios, but just the ongoing trend of polarization will continue to get much worse, and I mean not so much like the chaos, but it makes it basically impossible. Like just like the overall gridlock of any kind of positive plan to go forth politically. So yeah, we put out like our endorsements for these ballot measures and about the election. So It was a great show, and Matt, thanks for being on.
Yeah, no, I think this was an informative one, and you know, personally, this one affects the way I'm probably going to vote on some of these during the when I vote. So, much appreciated.